Hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And today's episode with Rob Hamilton is brought to you by Ledin and the Bitcoin Conference. Ledin offers interest-bearing savings accounts and Bitcoin-backed loans with the best rates in the entire industry, enabling users to access dollars or additional Bitcoin without needing to sell your existing holdings. That's right. Ledin is bringing financial services to Bitcoin that enable you to use your BTC as the pristine collateral that it is. Listeners of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast can get a free $50 in USDC when you become a Ledin user and take out a Ledin loan using our link. And for the rest of 2021, Ledin has increased their referral bonus to $50 in USDC. That means that you'll now get $50 in USDC every time your unique referral link is used to open and fund a Ledin savings account. Since they wanted to make this a win-win, your referral will also receive $50 in USDC. To learn more, sign up at start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. The Bitcoin Conference is going to be a celebration of Bitcoin, Bitcoiners, and this amazing movement that is going to make the world a better place. This is already a can't-miss event with all your favorite Bitcoiners in an amazing environment to chill, party, and learn. Prices are only going to go up, and they are eventually going to sell out. So if you haven't secured your tickets for the Bitcoin Conference, do it now at b.tc/conference and learn more about Bitcoin 2022, the amazing things that are happening in and around Miami, and to buy your tickets. And guess what? You can use the code Bitcoin Matrix for 10% off at checkout. Go and do it today. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Rob Hamilton, where we discuss the embedded growth obligation, an era of stagnation, universal institutional failure, and the Bitcoin mafia.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Rob Hamilton is a data scientist and consultant. Rob is also the author of two pieces published this year in Bitcoin Magazine: Why Has the Physical World Not Progressed Like the Digital? And Dissecting Mark Cuban's Thoughts on Bitcoin. In his free time, he loses money in poker and stacks sats. Rob Hamilton, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
Hey, Cedric, I'm doing well. Honored to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, man, we've had this in the works for a while. I think I reached out back in October. I love your first piece, Why Has the Physical World Not Progressed Like the Digital? And then, you know, we've even interacted a bit, I think, on Clubhouse and Twitter Spaces. Mm-hmm. But I don't know much about your background. What exactly is a data scientist? Or I know a little bit about it, but I mean, I don't get to talk to one that often.
Yeah. So data science, I would say it's a bit of a term of art in the sense that you don't go to school and get a degree in data science, right? I went to college, I got a degree in math and economics. So I was always very analytically minded. And data science fundamentally is taking processes and systems where you input data and you output some sort of analysis or modeling to get an answer to a question, right? Ultimately, you have a business question, you have pockets of data. Sometimes it's just, hey, can you visualize in a chart automatically what my daily revenue is or how many clicks I'm getting, or right? Like, they can be very simple, high-level stuff to where you even can get to more complicated models like computer vision. And you can get to, you know, maybe doing like what's called like artificial intelligence, like neural networks, like more complicated models. So my journey from there is I actually, to keep it somewhat condensed, because there's a lot of places the conversation can go. I got my degree in math and economics. I actually went to go work in advertising at a company called Major League Gaming. Esports was my first big career right out of college. I worked with those guys for the time I was in high school through college. And I helped basically run the whole ad server, which is the whole back end from when you load a website, what ads show up when, optimizing for yield. So basically the time the page loads to the time a check arrives in the mail for showing that ad, that whole back end process was something that I touched. So I ended up wanting to do work that was more technical, jumped around a little bit. And I went to go to Lambda School, which is now called Bloom Tech. They just rebranded, but Lambda School is this coding boot camp that fundamentally you take 6 months, you are coding 50 hours a week. And at the end of it, you basically have a career pivot. So I basically was teaching myself Python beforehand, but then I learned how to do full on programming through this. And I went to go work as a consultant. And that was like kind of like my fuller career arc, because I wanted to get into computer programming and writing code. So with data science, you're taking large pockets of data, sometimes in the terabytes of data, like very large data sets, and you're answering questions depending on the context. So that's kind of the general question on data science. It takes a lot of different forms, because you're fundamentally at the end of the day using computer code processes, cloud computing, to take data in and answer a business question, whether that's charts, models, interactive widgets, right? Like there's a lot of different ways it can go, but all depending on the context.
Sure. And so when did you come across Bitcoin? And, you know, I'm kind of wondering with math, economics, coding in your background.
So right out of college, this was around 2013. I had friends who said, like, hey, you should learn about Bitcoin. And I was kind of like, the story that everyone says, like, you know, you hear about it, you really don't pursue it. And actually the year 2013 is when I first heard about it, and when I first started going deep into it, because I got tapped like three different times from different people saying, like, hey, what's this Bitcoin thing? Like, hey, like, you're a Ron Paul guy, like, you should be interested in Bitcoin, right? Like all these like different, like different angles of people hitting me. And I was living in the suburbs outside New York City. And I went on to meetup.com of all places and typed in Bitcoin. And there was this thing called the New York Bit Devs Meetup, which is, so when I first started going in late 2013, early 2014, somewhere in that rough time frame, it was like 20 guys in a room. And it was kind of like very low profile, really amazing experience, because they met every other week. And I went week after week after week after week. And this is actually what got me wanting to learn how to do computer programming, because it was refreshing to walk into a room and be like, oh, I'm the dumbest person here. Everyone here is a wizard, and they understand this crazy technology called Bitcoin. I want to learn more about it, right? It became not just this like economic, like philosophical exercise, but it became this like very rigorous exercise in game theory and things I don't even still fully understand, but with distributed systems, with everyone having their own copy of a node, a leaderless movement, a flat hierarchy, like very interesting concepts I started like wrestling with. So I went to the Bit Devs meetup in New York City for probably about like a year and a half. And I changed jobs. I was still working in the city. And it's not that I didn't care anymore. I always kept tabs on it, but just life got busy. And that's really what really kicked things off. And then from a public face, like I was always engaged on Twitter, Reddit, following along with the discussion, but very low profile in the sense that I felt like there were plenty of smart people who way knew more than me to like speak to things. And then the pandemic happened and I got on Clubhouse because everyone was locked inside, and I started talking to all these other Bitcoiners. And that was like an interesting change in the journey for me, from being someone who was passively following Bitcoin to someone who was more actively like being involved with the dialogue. So that was like January of this year, like February of this year. Brent Harrington, who runs the Orange County, Los Angeles, like Bitcoin meetup, like he got me an invite onto Clubhouse when it was still like really hard to get an invite. And I just started going in all the Bitcoin rooms. And that was a huge experience for me, being someone who would talk to Bitcoin. And you would have weeks in like January, February, March, where like people like, what's a wallet? How do I do this? And it was like, you often think about like, how would you pitch someone in person with Bitcoin? But with Clubhouse, every day there was like 20 different people that you were like sharpening your answers to and like really refining your rhetoric when it came to conversation. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that was a really enjoyable experience for me. And from there, talking with a couple people on Clubhouse, probably most people here would know American Hoddle. He is not on Twitter, but he is alive and well on Clubhouse. Him and I were bantering a lot back and forth about a lot of different things that we shared common interests in. And one of them was this interview with Eric Weinstein and Peter Thiel, the episode one of the Eric Weinstein podcast, The Portal. And that's what kicked off my article. So that kind of ties things to current day from the beginning of my journey to the end.
Right. Now, I'm a little mystified though. So between 2013 and 2021, I mean, do you think of yourself as a class of 2013 or the class of 2021? Were you using Bitcoin as a savings vehicle?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I was holding it along the way. I held my own keys. I ran my own node. Like, I was technically enough minded to like go through that journey where I made conscious decisions. You know, when the first time I bought a Bitcoin, it was $230, something like that, probably in that ballpark. That was like the first time I bought, and, you know, lost some along the way, but also like, you know, it's part of that learning process that everyone has, but I would consider myself a class of 2013, 2014, because I was in it. I was using it. I had friends, I paid people in Bitcoin. You know, like, it was definitely something I was touching and using, but the technology, I used to be the guy who would, around the offices at Major League Gaming, I would get people to download wallets on their phone and I would send them 10 million sats because it was $20 at the time. And the only person who held on to it all those years later was a buddy of mine who was a streamer on Twitch TV. And I helped him, and this is back in 2015 or so, set up a plugin to like receive donations in Bitcoin on his, and the way, because he didn't understand technology, I was like, here's a Coinbase account, just use it. Sure enough, that one 10 million sat donation I sent to him for like $20, he's the only one who held on to it because it went directly into his Coinbase wallet and he never lost it. So he's like, so like in 2020, like, he hit me up, he's like, dude, like, I have like $3,000 here because it hit $30,000, right? And I've always been like, I've been the Uncle Jim for my circle of friends, is the best way I would phrase it, right? It's like, whenever there was a Bitcoin question, how do I do this? What's that, right? Like, I was always inbounding those questions from 2014 through 2021. It's just, the difference for me was just being, verbalizing and like sharing stories and anecdotes and thinking I was qualified enough to like speak to it versus, you know, being more passive going through the experience. Yeah. And I think that's, for most people, I think people who have Bitcoin, they're not on Bitcoin Twitter. I think they're just like, they're holding it, like, follow along. They're not actively engaged in dialogue. Maybe they're more naturally introverts, right? I think that's what majority of the people who hold Bitcoin are probably doing.
Yeah. Do you remember, because all this is fascinating, do you remember sort of your journey and when you maybe like first bought Bitcoin and you're thinking, are you speculating it at this point? You mentioned that, you know, one of your taps was, like, someone mentioned that you're into Ron Paul. That brings the political side into Bitcoin. It's
yeah.
The math, the economics, the coding. You know, when do you remember, like, when you maybe took ownership of your own keys and what that meant for you then? Did you, you know, like, was it always trying to get your keys off an exchange? Was that sort of an evolution?
I never held a lot on an exchange just because something that was always really personally appealing to me was the sovereignty of Bitcoin. And I got in pre-Mt. Gox collapse.
Mm.
But I also never signed up for an account at Mt. Gox. Like, I joined when Coinbase was already a website that was well-established enough. And Coinbase was really the only game in town, like the main game in town, if you were a US citizen back in 2013, 2014, right? Like, this is before there was even Ethereum, which is funny enough, that New York BitDevs meetup in late 2014, early 2015, I was still going to it. Vitalik and the whole Ethereum founding team went to it and gave a presentation. So I got to like meet Vitalik in that pre-launch stage of kicking things off. So like, when you're going that far back in time, like, Coinbase was the main shop in town. I ran Bitcoin Core on my computer, just like most people did, because there were some wallets that were around there. I think there was one called Millibit. There was Armory for like your serious hardcore stuff. And there was a couple other ones, but like, for me, I was like, oh, well, this is the official Bitcoin wallet. I'm just going to use this, call it a day. And for me, that was something I was always doing, because when I was going to these technical meetups and there were like these very smart people talking about Bitcoin Core protocol change. And I'm not sure if you've ever been to a BitDevs, but it's a really interesting and intense process where they go through all of the pull requests and the GitHub issues of like the latest things that are happening. And they go through all the comments, and the way the BitDevs meetings run, they run as a Socratic meetup. So literally it's a flat like hierarchy, just like Bitcoin, where anyone in any, like, there's a guy, Jay, brilliant, smart guy, who runs it in New York, but anyone can raise their hand and start talking at any point. It's an open, there is no like, you know, I'm the boss, you're like, your time's done speaking. And because of that, you get very good, like, I've heard Marty Bent describe it before, is that you just go to them and you just hope you absorb like 5% of it. And just like every time you absorb another 5%, you'll get there eventually. But so because I was talking to all these technical people, I felt more, and I was always good with computers. I wasn't a programmer, but so going off and downloading like a .exe for like my Windows computer wasn't that big of a leap. So it's something that I was always like poking and playing around with. Like, I was a poor kid out of college though, so I didn't have a lot of capital to throw around. So everyone thinks that like I'm off on a yacht now, and it's really not the case.
Yeah. I mean, that's a lot of money, even especially the further back we go in time, less inflation. And it's a lot of money, especially for a young person to put into an asset, any asset really. A lot of people, even at that age, maybe lucky or to have the mindset to put, and I'm not suggesting people go into 401k, but pre-Bitcoin, or not everyone's even, you know, savings in any way they can, even in these monetized vehicles. It's really interesting. You got to meet, you know, Vitalik, not interesting to meet Vitalik, but I'm really curious what your thinking was when these projects were being launched. Ethereum wasn't the first shitcoin,
right? I mean, and like, you have to view it back in 2015, there wasn't this larger culture where like the DAO had not happened yet, right? There had not been the rollback. There hadn't been like the 20 pivots on what this is. And it genuinely was interesting meeting him. And what I thought was most interesting was the way the meetings would run is they would like, the first hour was always very standard, like going through GitHub, going through all the things. And usually you'd have someone that would do like a presentation near the end. And then everyone goes across the street to have drinks at the bar. And what was interesting about this was that he actually had like a full posse of like 20 people with him that rolled in, which is like the Ethereum founding team. And it was the weirdest thing ever, because when people did presentations, like it was like one, maybe two people saying like, hey, here's this project I'm prototyping, or hey, there's this thing I'm doing, like very, very low key. And this was a much different energy. And having like followed around the discussion on like Reddit, I was more on Reddit than Twitter at the time when it came to Bitcoin stuff, like hearing about this like new thing that was launching, it was interesting. Very eccentric in person, his mannerisms and ticks, the way you see him in videos, same guy you see in person. But I mean, it was a random throwaway event that like I didn't know ahead of time that he was coming, but he came, did his talk. And at the end of the day, I think like you have to view things in the context of the time where they happened. There was no Bitcoin maximalism culture. There wasn't anything really more than Bitcoin. Right. I mean, there were other coins besides Bitcoin, but usually they were just forks of Bitcoin where they just changed like Litecoin, like, oh, it's 84 million, not 21 million, right? Like they're very simple things. Most of the stuff that was going on wasn't really that advanced at the time.
Yeah.
It was more obvious to see what a scam was.
Yeah. I mean, my gut instinct is that team of 20 that came in with him runs him, that they're above him. He's sort of like the figurehead. And I'm not sure if he, yeah. But jumping to 2021, what, I mean, you've been on Clubhouse a lot. It's really interesting, you know, you got to meet Vitalik back in the day, now you know, Eric Weinstein, American Hodl. There's been a lot of interesting people up in Clubhouse. What has that experience been like? And sort of, I think, yeah, what kind of brought you back into the fold at such a strong force?
So getting like the start of the pandemic in 2020, I got my years mixed up with
Yeah,
it was around January of 2020 last year. So it was January of last year. Although now I'll have to like, look, was it, I'm going to look at my phone right now.
January 2021 is like when Clubhouse like launched, or like right after Christmas, around Christmas Day.
Yeah. I was nominated January 11th, 2021. So 2020 happens. I'm kind of following along. I'm way more active, passively following things on Bitcoin Twitter at this point. I'm fully plugged in by like 2018, 2019, like after the 2017 cycle, like I realized that Reddit had really declined in its quality of discourse and that Twitter was the place to be, but I wasn't really posting or actively really doing. Occasionally I would like tweet a thing or two, but like, it wasn't really my active spot. So when Clubhouse really started popping off in early this year in 2021, what really pulled me in was like, I would go into these rooms and hear people talk about Bitcoin, and they really didn't fully understand it, maybe to the level that I did, or they were still newer on their Bitcoin journey, just kind of talking about it. So that's what really pulled me in. And I got to talk to Eric. I still talk to Eric several times pretty regularly on the app. He it's been really interesting talking to him because he would specifically come in when the price crashed. Cause we would like go back and forth and banter and debate and fight. And he was like, listen guys, like this is like when the price went from like 50 to 30, whatever. Right. This is like over the summer. Mm-hmm. He's like, I'm on your side. Like if I was an enemy, I'd be like dancing and like shoving the football, like spiking the football in your face. Like, but like we are fellow travelers and I believe in Bitcoin and where we can, I hope we can work together. Right. So it was really good to like hear these conversations from him over many months to where he can kind of show that even if there's disagreements, I would say he's a good faith actor. And a lot of like, it's been fun on Clubhouse too. Like I find it to be a really good group of people. A lot of very successful people who are like, I find, just like going to those BitDev meetups where I would go into a room. I'm like, oh, I'm one of the dumbest people here. Like I, like oftentimes on Clubhouse in conversations, like a lot of successful entrepreneurs or people who, you know, have their own walks in life who have very unique, different experiences that I can learn a lot from. And I find that really to be rewarding. I love spending time on Clubhouse doing that. And also just talking ideas and big picture, whether it's, you know, sometimes you just get Bitcoin Tina, someone jumps into the room and says how like Bitcoin will never work as money. And then you get Bitcoin Tina just like ripping a guy's throat out for like 20 minutes, which is hilarious in its own right. Neil's done some really funny edits, put them up on Twitter. And then, or like you have HODL, and I like, we would spend hours talking about this article I was writing. Cause it took me probably 15 hours to write it just because I wanted to get all these thoughts together and listen through that podcast a couple times to kind of like steel man Eric's larger macro thesis about stagnation. And I've just found it to be really engaging. And like, you never know what's going to happen on a given day. I think there's also something about the medium of Clubhouse where it's an open dialogue. We're all having questions and debate. And you can see quickly, as opposed to like Twitter, where people are typing things up, who actually understands stuff on a first principles basis to have a free flowing, casual conversation, kind of like what we're having right now. For finding the truth, it's a really effective medium for understanding for who, if someone's talking, do they actually understand on first principles the things that they're describing or thinking through, or is someone just kind of repeating what other people have said? Right. So I think that's been a really useful thing for me, is to help me gain my conviction in Bitcoin. Like I wasn't selling Bitcoin in the bear market, but I had a newfound resolve in Bitcoin's confidence and spending a lot more time. And I think HODL's said this before, is that basically like the lone wolf stacks less, because like, sure, like you're going to have the conviction, you believe in yourself, but unless you have that internal support peer group that goes through the experience with you, you can feel isolated and you may not stack as much, or you may sell some and you have weaker conviction, because human beings are social animals at the end of the day, right? So you want to have that peer group that kind of is along with the journey with you.
Yeah. It's so interesting that I love that you got to talk to Eric. I remember I think I might have heard that episode around when it came out. I was really excited for it. It was kind of I think one of the first non-Bitcoin focused podcasts I was excited to listen to in a long time and hear a different perspective. I kind of burned out after around 8 or 9 episodes, to be honest, of the portal. But I did find that conversation very interesting. I now find your piece a more enjoyable representation of that experience. I love the piece. I went back to the pod and
it's a good podcast.
It's a good podcast, but it's a bit long in terms of and I think around, you know, maybe because I was listening to it a second time after having read your article, I kind of enjoyed the article at that point a lot more. I think it kind of clarified a lot of the ideas for me. And so I'd kind of love to jump into some of those.
Certainly.
Yeah. And what are the two poles, you know, that kind of push or pull in society?
Yeah. So this is something that I actually didn't get this in the article, but I think it's something that kind of spun from that conversation, is that you have growth and you have violence. At the end of the day, you have these poles in society where fundamentally there's a military like tactic saying that like when goods don't cross borders, soldiers do. So if you don't have economic coordination, you don't have trade, you're much more likely to go into like a physical altercation in warfare. So growth and violence being the two major poles in society, to kind of lay out a bit of the template of the conversation Eric had talks about this with Peter Thiel, and that first episode is definitely my favorite from the podcast series. I didn't listen to everything, but I also kind of got burnt out on it. You have my article goes into like two major pieces where there's something that Eric calls an embedded growth obligation. And there's some like the stagnation of between bits and atoms. Like, so the embedded growth obligation and plain definition is, at what rate of growth does an institution need to have for it to maintain its honest positions? And Peter Thiel, who formerly was a lawyer, uses law school as a perfect example of this, saying that you have a bunch of people who go to law school, they go work at a law firm afterwards, and they're all trying to work their way to become like a top partner, because that's where all of the status is and that's where all the money is. Well, at first, as people are being funneled through the law school, you're able to work your way up and make your way to that top position. But over time, if you have more and more people going to law school, eventually you get to a place where not everyone can make it to the top position. So the growth kind of stagnates. And when the growth stagnates, the institution moves from being like maintaining its honest positions, whatever they may are, and it goes beyond law schools to one that may be a little bit more parasitic and lying. And in a general sense, if institutions at large are supposed to be like our sense-making organs in society, if they start lying to us, it could have disastrous consequences for the cohesion of a general society, right? So the Bitcoin, the orange paint coat, you could say, I put across this, because in this 3-hour conversation between Eric Weinstein and Peter Thiel, Bitcoin's not mentioned once. Not only that,
yeah,
there's one sentence saying that the gold standard ended in 1971, because they're talking about this general sense of like, it's so funny. And I was talking to American HODL about this when I was writing the article. Like Peter Thiel says, like, oh, you know, it's sometime between, I'm trying to do my Thiel impression, but it's like sometime between like 68 and 72, like things really started going off the rails in the country. And Eric's like, I think it was like 1973. Like they're all right there when 1971 happened. And the way I've thought about this is that if money is a technology, right? And this is a bit of a where, and please jump in at any point, because I'm kind of bouncing around a couple different points from the article. But if you have these two poles, growth and violence, and money is a technology, just as a base premise for a second, like different money evolves over time because it's fundamentally technology. We got to gold bars because it's what we found to have the best principles of what a good money has. Money is ultimately a coordination function of society. If it's half of all of the transactions you trade, apples for gold, or you know, your dollars for your labor, and then like it allows fair coordination in society. And when that starts to break down, you start getting bad signals thrown into the market, where the metaphor I thought up is like, they mentioned in the interview, is that basically even apple orchard, and like the really good apples are at the top of the trees and they're a little bit harder to get to. This is where I came in. They were talking about like, there's no more low hanging fruit in science. And I made the point that like, actually money is like a ladder. And when you think about it, like when we were cavemen, the wheel and fire were massive revolutions in technology when we were very primitive animals, which allowed us to kind of like climb higher up in the apple orchard to find like new fruits of our labor, right? And more prosperity in society. When the money broke, though, we lost the coordination function in society for us to extend the ladder higher and higher. So when you have the money break down, you no longer can have a fair economic coordination of resources to actually have better investment and be able to actually find new breakthroughs in technology. And this jumps into the other part of the article, and I'll pause for a second, is that there's been largely a stagnation in the world of atoms since the early 70s. And all of the technological process we've seen has been in the world of bits. So think computers. But the world of physical atoms, like physical innovation, has been much more de minimis compared to with Moore's law, how much has been accelerated and aided because of technology innovation with computers, you know, every 18 months with Moore's law, doubling the compute power for half the price. And just, and the one example, like, is just like in general, like we went to the moon in 1968 with the computing power of a graphing calculator. And now it's a big headline if like we go to low Earth orbit with like Deep Blue, Origin, and like and SpaceX. Like, we're not actually even doing the big moonshot right. stuff, right? So it's just a lot of different pieces there. Please,
why do you think they're celebrating, you know, going to, you know, sort of this going to orbit when we've gone to the moon before?
I think it's, well, one, fundamentally, because we shut that door for so long. Like, we lost full ambition. Like, we lost our ambition, and now that someone's showing an amount of effort, it's exciting again, right? Like, think about if you grew up any time between like 1973, we've landed on the moon in 1972. If you were growing, like if you're a kid growing up from like, let's call it just like 78 to two, like I'm trying to think, I know that because we've had some space programs, we never actually went to the moon, right? Like, you never had those like big rally moments anymore where like everyone would go on TV,
right.
watch the big landing and the big takeoff and stuff. And I think we're hopefully turning to a better, more optimistic time where space travel is going to be more plentiful and like happening more regularly again. Yeah, it's an interesting question. I take it down to like, we've lost our ambition, but the space program got retired, basically shut off by the government. And then you had private sector step in. I think people feel like you finally get to see these launches again that kind of paused. So I think it's hopeful to see it come back.
Yeah. What do you think was sort of peak America? I'm starting to think it was the 1990s.
Interesting. So I would have called it the 50s, like the golden era of capitalism post-World War II. This is where you get suburbia, the white picket fences. This sure. is where you get basically the total collapse of Europe post-World War II, because everyone had been bombed. And like, this is really where all of the growth in American prosperity of like the American dream, everyone got their picket fence and new car and the nuclear family, like full everything fully taking off, full suburbia sprawl. I think that's kind of what a lot of people are calling back to and yeah. what they feel is missing. Like, they feel like, you know, they see this Brady Bunch-esque, which I know is a little bit later in the 60s, 70s, but like they see this like idyllic like vision of what the American dream is supposed to be. You have a house, you have a family, you have a car, you're able to, you know, be part of a larger community. And that's all kind of fragmented off. I'm interested to hear though, what makes you say the 1990s?
Yeah. And I'll probably reclassify there and say maybe peak fiat America.
Oh yeah.
But, I think in a lot of ways, if you look back on say classic movies from the 90s or TV shows,
yeah,
the family sitting at the dinner table, there's no politics. There's less division, at the family level. There's sort of optimism and hope for the future. America is sort of thought of as strong and classically thought of as number one in the world at that moment.
Fall maybe. Of the Soviet Union.
The fall of the Soviet Union.
Right.
You have that. Sort of maybe in a lot of ways peak of Adam's innovation in terms of communications, at least with bits. So or maybe bits and Adams, but like we're getting new telecommunications. Mm-hmm. And we're, you know, so now you have America Online, you have chat rooms, everything that came in the 2000s was sort of, an iteration of that kind of technology. It just seems the last time America was sort of happy and hopeful for the future.
That's interesting. It's funny because I grew up in the 90s. So it's definitely a time that's more real to me in the sense that I lived it as opposed to like looking back at like historical film and like perspectives from historians. And you also had like the internet was just starting to take off. It was like this, and which the internet in its own way was its new wild frontier. That's interesting. Yeah. And it did happen post 1971. So you could say peak fiat America. It was almost
the peak usefulness of fiat.
Yeah. Well, you had full American hegemony. It was before 9/11 and using the debasement of money to just have, you know, a very long war that just kind of drained the riches of the United States. No, it's an interesting way to think about it. And it's definitely, if you look at the charts, like you're still 15 years out from great financial crisis. So you don't have the pseudo nationalization of the banks and the stock market where they get to keep all of the gains. But the moment that, you know, they fall apart, the American taxpayer comes in to pick it up. That's an interesting, it's kind and of
homes before, are still, you know, affordable at this point.
Right.
College is still relatively affordable. It's getting out of reach, but it's still a decent proposition and bet on yourself that depending on what area of interest you study and what job you could obtain after college, you might get a decent ROI. things of that nature.
Well, it's interesting because like it's like you have less pressure because you had the Cold War, but the beauty of the Cold War is that you didn't have active conflict zones in the sense that we had, you know, tens of thousands of American troops deployed overseas, right? So you don't have that economic drain. You have that mental drain of everyone worrying about, like, you know, what Russia's going to do. I'm just thinking that through. It's interesting because it's almost as if, like, the way I would almost view it is that America was kind of living off the fumes of the pre-1971 America.
I think
where we were still sitting at the front of the... We were still sitting in the driver's seat. We still commanded all of the intellectual capital for the most part, military capital post, you know, World War II. No one had really challenged us. Our challengers were a whole ocean away. American exceptionalism wasn't controversial to think that America was the best country, you know, that had the best rights and the best governing system. Yeah, and I think it's almost as if like you just have continual destabilizing events like 9/11, great financial crisis, COVID now, where you... The hegemony is fine until it gets properly challenged. And I think what's interesting about at least the COVID and the great financial crisis is that those were like internally imposed conflicts, right? You could have a bunch of opinions on how long we should have stayed in Iraq and Afghanistan, but, and that would make like being seen as an external threat. But like we decided to, bail out the banks. Like that was, and it's funny because it was, it was one of those things where talking with friends, I was like, you do know that like the Democrats voted for that. Just, and it wasn't that like the Republicans were like going to fully stand up and oppose it. A lot of Republicans crossed aisles, but talking to like my progressive friends in like the mid to late like 2010s, right. And talking about politics and like, you do know that it was like Obama did not veto the bill. Right. And it was always like, well, sorry, it was under Bush, but it was right in the interim before that everything started. But it was just like, it was a bipartisan effort. Everyone was on board for this, right? And I remember going down to Occupy Wall Street when I was in college and like following that whole, like the whole collapse and basically not collapse literally, but like that whole conflict with the great financial crisis. And you could feel like that's when the energy started changing in the country.
Yeah.
I think that was like the full turning point for me being someone in college and turning around that edge. Obviously 9/11, massively impactful. But I think to your point about the 90s, I think you had this like halo effect that just started dwindling as 9/11, great financial crisis, all this other stuff starts kind of destabilizing and kind of pointing out a problem.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I kind of, for me personally, I think in 1998, I think with the long-term capital management, I think was the first time I was like, all right, the system is rigged. and you know, unless I, you know, like it's sort of the pyramid scheme, and I did join a big four accounting firm and I saw the path ahead of me there, and very similar to the law firms, but you know, you're going to pledge your way to being partner. You're going to put in grueling hours and hope to make it and hope there's enough seats for you at the end of the game. And then after that, there's the war, you know, the Iraq war. And I think that was sort of like, all right, now politically, I kind of think a lot of the case or the evidence for the Iraq war was, didn't seem very truthful. It seems fabricated in retrospect. And I think it was obvious at the time. So that was another sort of break in my mind. And then by the time we get to 2000, you know, 9/11's included in there, not almost in the same way at the time, but very big event. And then 2008 is sort of the bookend of that decade, you know, from 1998 to 2008. And it's sort of really obvious for everyone. It's financially, the system is rigged. Politically, it's rigged. And we're sending kids off to die for this stuff.
You know, it's 98 to 2008. It's an interesting way to bookend that.
Bitcoin born in 2008. I mean, there's just so much.
Yeah, I think that's such a great, I think that's such a great content. Like, sometimes it gets overlooked when people talk like how long Bitcoin's been around. It was born in the throes of the great financial crisis. And I think it's hard to separate it from that context, right? Not only that, but with Satoshi and the Genesis block talking about Chancellor on the brink of bailout for second bailout for banks. Like I think this is all, like, I often think about, and this was what one of the deeper points I got into with the article, was that an interest rate fundamentally is this negotiation between the present and the future. And for me, I have a young family. I have two kids under two. Like for me, a lot of like, coming in through COVID, and like my wife was pregnant before COVID started, had another kid during all of this. I feel this building sense of tension and frustration. I think it's a lot of people that other, like other Bitcoiners feel about, you know, trying to start families, trying to like, you know, do right by our kids. And we're living in a system that almost just wants to like, just like they are political pawns and sacrifices for a greater mission, whether it's kid, like 3-year-olds masking as by federal mandate when they're on planes, or kindergartners being masked everywhere they go, or even in a longer term perspective, just like if the interest rates are this low, like like your interest rate's the hurdle rate for a fair investment, right? So if you have 10% interest on an investment, the idea is that if you go out and make an investment somewhere and you make less than 10%, it's a waste, right? But if you make more than that, you're beating like the savings account you could get in your leaving in your savings account, right? And the higher the savings rate is, like the higher the interest rate is, the more you're rewarded for deferring gratification. It's a lock in easy win. If I can just hold my money in the bank and hold off, maybe I'm a young person like working and starting a family, and I want to sock away a bunch of the money I'm earning so that my kids can have a more stable life in 5 to 10 years. And that's totally robbed from you. Now you have to go into this, like this den of liars and thieves in the casino of, whether it's like the larger crypto market or the stock market, right? Like you basically have to like put a gun to your own head and try and make it through it on the other end. And like that's not a hero's journey. I think that's really admirable. And I think that's kind of been the interesting counter narrative with just, you know, buying Bitcoin, dollar cost averaging, you know, saving your Bitcoin, holding it for the long term. And it provides you this more constructive avenue to build something better for the future, right? And I the way I phrased it in the article is that there was basically that, you know, as the 30 rate interest rate, like your mortgage rate and your interest rate in general is being pushed lower and lower, you're creating artificial growth. And this goes into the larger embedded growth obligation conversation, that basically with suppressing interest rates, you were able to create the illusion of growth. If you lower the interest rates, more people start spending money, people save less. So even though like we got debased off like, you know, the gold standard, we can make it look like there's a happen in economic activity because we drop the interest rates. And you keep doing that and you keep doing that and you keep doing that. And the way I phrased it in the article was that basically the ruling class of mainly silent generation and baby boomers, our political class, are sacrificing the future of millennials and Gen Z onto a financial pyre in the service of their one true God, the embedded growth obligation. Because at the end of the day, if you're a politician, you're just trying to show good GDP numbers and everything's hunky-dory so you can get reelected and maintain power. And that's been the easiest thing to do because it's inflation is just a way to do taxation without getting consent of the governed. You just lower the interest rates, you print more money, you do, you know, you have a an asset swap where you basically have the, I love Lynn Alden's way of saying it, where the way that when quantitative easing is basically you have a restaurant and the biggest customer is the chef of the restaurant. It's such a great way I explain to people who aren't like macro minded or like want to get in the weeds on like how the system works, because it doesn't make economic sense and it brings growth today. But now we're even starting to see like reaping what we sow with like 6% inflation, right? And trying to like, inflation's good for you now. It used to always be bad, but now it's good for you, right? Like all these narrative wars to try and protect the embedded growth obligation. Because at the end of the day, growth is how the current power structure maintains power. So it's growth at all costs. And yeah, it's one of those things that I think Bitcoin's been a fun antidote to start seeing it. And the way sometimes I phrase it is that Bitcoin's just riding on top of the embedded growth obligation in the sense that you're able to, as the currency devalues and all of these assets start shooting up in value, you just have the best asset. You have the best racehorse in the race. And you're able to just almost kind of lean into it and understand, like saying, hey, this is broken. There's a better way on the other side of this, but I'll also take appreciation in the midterm while things kind of shake out.
Yeah. I want to go back to when you mentioned that, like institutions, like what happens when they become parasitic and lying, and like what is institutional betrayal? And I'm kind of curious what you think maybe Peter and Eric would think about how things have developed since their conversation with institutions.
Yeah. So institutional betrayal, it's mentioned in the interview, and I mentioned it in the article because I thought that there's something there to kind of think through more. There is this psychologist, her name's, I'm looking up, Jennifer Freid, F-R-E-Y-D. And institutions, when they take caretaking roles, when they violate the trust they have as like custodians, you have this outsized trauma that gets impacted by the agents that make up that like power structure, right? So I think her example was, if you have colleges and you have someone who gets attacked on the college campus, like, you know, there's an outsized impact if the college hasn't lived up to, you know, protecting the students, right? But the lens that I start taking it to is that fundamentally the Federal Reserve is supposed to be, they're the ones in charge with the money printer, right? They're the ones that get to control the money supply. And fundamentally, these are people that by extension are part, they work for the US citizen, and they're betraying their mandate to protect the larger population in service of a smaller class of people and political pressures that they're adhering to instead. And that's why Jerome Powell every time is going to hit that, you know, the quantitative easing button. He's going to hit the money printer button. He's going to like buying up not only just US government debt, but also buying mortgage-backed securities every month, propping up the US housing market, right? And it's because most people in the country view houses as their one main savings vehicle, but it's pricing out anyone who doesn't own property from being able to ever join that class. And he's going to do that because he has certain political pressures that are going to have him betray his actual mandate of, and kind of from there, just kind of, you know, it's a political trade-off. And because of that, you have a lot of people who get very upset because these are people who are in control and they're violating their position of authority.
Right. Yeah. And that's in the political sphere. And what about like corporations? Like what kind of prisoner's dilemma do they face?
Yeah. So I wrote about this in the article. So I formerly worked at IBM prior to, I left there, I guess it was in June. It was right around the conference for Miami, but they between 1995 and 2020 did $220 billion in stock buybacks. Now, stock buyback being every quarter, every year, when you have your leftover, you're running a business, you get a certain amount of cash flow that comes in at the end of the day after you pay all of your expenses, your profit, you try and figure out what you're going to do with that money. You can either invest it, you can pay off a dividend, or you can buy back your own stock shares, or you can save the money in the bank for another day, which is like what Michael Saylor did. He had half a billion dollars sitting in the bank as he was running his business, right? The prisoner's dilemma that happens with corporations here is that the people who are at the top, the people who won the game in the embedded growth obligation, they're sitting at the top. They're on the board of directors. They're the CEO. They're the chief executive suite of a large Fortune 500 company. Their compensation primarily is stock. It's not salary. You're not getting paid $20 million a year as a CEO. You're getting paid, let's just say, like $400,000 a year and $30 million in stock options. So if that's your compensation plan and you're running the company, the easiest thing to do to make sure that you're giving yourself a raise within the corporate structure and also being able to pay lip service that you're doing your fiduciary responsibility of looking out for shareholders is use all that leftover cash, buy up a shit ton of stock and pump up your own stock price and give yourself a huge like effective raise, like pay raise when your time to collect. And I pick on IBM specifically because the company currently, so they did $200 billion between 1995 and today. The company is only worth $120 billion today. So they took literally like 1.6x of the entire company's value today over the past 30 years. Now, mind you, $1995 went a lot further than $2021, right? So when you start thinking about like, this is just nominal. This isn't even an inflation adjusted or money supply adjusted, right? How much of that money could have went to doing larger moonshot projects that would take 10 years to pan out? You're talking hundreds of billions of dollars here. And this is like the prisoner's dilemma where for the actual long-term growth of the company, the healthy, responsible thing to do in a normal society that wasn't kind of degraded by central banking would be to invest that money, maybe pay back some dividends to shareholders, some sort of blended mix, right? And I'm sure some of those investments would have blown up fabulously on the launch pad. There would have been some horrible investments, but you can't tell me that like all of that $200 billion would have like not gone to anything meaningful to help improve our quality of life, right? And this is the prisoner's dilemma, is that these large companies are just able to service themselves in the corporate C-suite and really damn the future. It's what it is. At the end of the day, you're buying back stock. You're saying, I have no better use for this money. I'm just going to go buy back stock. And it's such a slap in the face for anyone who would work at a company where there's real resources. And like, if you ever work at a company, like of a decent size, there's a lot of negotiation and navigating, trying to figure out what your budget is for the next year. What are your priorities? What's your mandate? Trying to work within responsible budget and find, hopefully your business unit's profitable. All just to go to the top and get blown out through stock buybacks. Because if you're a Joe Schmo employee at a company, you're not getting a disproportionate stock buyback output as your salary. So you're living on salary. So it's actually a wealth extraction where you have all of these worker ants that are just ultimately at the end of the day, just going right to the top and giving all of the value to that top elite class.
Yeah. It's just so insidious. And I think it permeates so many spheres of corporate America where just so many things are done, maybe ass backwards or create just hardships for employees, but are not felt by the C-suite. And I think you summed it up best in your article. You said, imagine suggesting to your boss 7 levels removed from the CEO that this is a horrible idea and that capital can be invested in new ventures and not buybacks or whatever it is that you think would be better for the company. This would be actively attacking the embedded growth obligation of executive paychecks. For these leaders, they participate in this shared lie. And every person who wishes to climb the hierarchy of these institutions has to play along. I see this a lot with at a very high level, when like a company gets a new CFO and they're like, all right, we're going to scratch everything the old CFO was working on. All those projects are dead. Every single report that he was receiving or she was receiving is wrong. I like it a different way. When you went left to right, I want it up to down. And we're going to spend 18 months overhauling everything in the organization to do it this way, no matter what the second and third order effects on everybody else, on FP&A, accounting, legal, HR, whatever it is. We got to get it done. And then that guy or girl leaves in 22 months and, and goes, plays musical chairs for the new bonus so somewhere else. And then you get a whole legacy of, back office workouts of, we do that because in, 2007, we switched to this ERP system, but we didn't put it in correctly because we stopped halfway through. And now we're on this system and we got to make them speak to each other and whatever it is. It's just, and I think it really kills the spirit in a lot of these workplaces. Feeding this shared lie.
Absolutely. I think it's one of these things where it's a tough field to navigate as someone who's trying to figure out what you want to do with your career, but you just lose full agency and the ability to execute everything. Because prior to being there, I worked at a bunch of startups, right? So small, the largest one had like maybe 200 employees, but it was going through a lot of series fundraising stuff. But my first company out of college had 40 people working for them, right? And you had the ability to have impact and influence. And it's one of those trade-offs where, you spend a lot of hours working on things that aren't meaningful and impactful because someone's boss's boss's boss wants you to do something. And it's an email to one person, but then it's a weekend to another person. Right. And you find out that like how many of those exercises actually had impact. This is where it gets, running a large company is not an enviable position, right? Where you're basically trying to move like a cruise ship to try and turn. You have to do it like miles ahead of time. But it's such a complicated coordination function. Like you said, there's also a lot of ego involved where I want to do this, I want to do that. And then you're just flipping things over and you never actually get into a steady state groove of achieving work. You're just constantly resurfacing like the latest ego, like totally empathize with that. Yeah. It can be very complicated.
Yeah. And, we've been mentioning the Great Stagnation and Bits versus Adams. And, where do you think, we sort of are in this arc. We're in this what seems to be Great Stagnation. We mentioned that we might have peaked in the 1950s or the 1990s.
So just to fully lay out the Bits for Adams part real quick, because Peter Thiel gives this example, I think it's just a way to concretely think about it, is that if you were to walk into a room from the... If you were to walk into a room and you just did not count the computer screens or the monitors, what's different from the room fundamentally other than like aesthetic taste and choice and fashion, right? And that's to speak to the fact that we really haven't materially changed the way we live our lives and in the world of physical atoms, whereas bits and computers fiber optics, I think to your point, talking about like the internet itself is like definitely one of those few innovations. Those are like the key drives that we've actually had change. So the where I think we are on this, I think we're at a certain point where with the help of Bitcoin over the next 15 to 20 years, I don't think you're able to keep the charade going on for much longer, in the sense that I think we're hitting really the final death throes of the financial system as it's currently architected. You like the desperate pivots of something like a central bank digital currency, which I think it's its own interesting conversation in its own right. Because if you were a central planner, like economist, a central bank digital currency is like the dream opportunity for you to collect data on everything and be able to have to the individual financial policy, which is really just control and oppression. It's not actually, it would be painted as, hey, we can make our economy much more efficient. But what you're going to fundamentally have at the end of the day is you're going to have a class of people where some people get really nice interest rates. And then, oh, well, your social credit score went negative. Like, so you don't get to actually have a savings account anymore, right? Like, it's not, for the central planner, it's a perfect opportunity. But for anyone who wants to be free market associated, it's a literal nightmare. So I think this is just me, like, not particularly on the exact timelines and dates. I think over the next, you know, 15, 20 years, though, you're going to have Bitcoin continue to ascend its role and showing its fact as the better neutral money of the world. And because of that, you're going to have better capital allocation. Now, when you spend Bitcoin and you don't properly calculate and decide where it should be going, there's no bailouts. But I send you a Bitcoin and investment proposition, and you aren't a good business person, or you run off with the money, whatever, there is no backdoor float of like a proof of stake system where I have a bunch of money, so I get a bunch more money coming in. That goes one way and it's never coming back. Right. And that's why I think is really interesting about Bitcoin from a long run macroeconomic coordination. And that's not to even say that a lot of Bitcoiners today who have a lot of Bitcoin, by the time their great grandkids are running around, usually wealth is gone within three generations, right? So it's not even like you're going to have this permanent elite class of people who got into Bitcoin between 2009 and 2020 being this elite class of people. Like, that's life in capitalism in a true free market system. It's that you miscalculate, you lose, you don't get it back. And oftentimes after multiple generations of wealth security, it gets squandered when the people who never had to fight or work for anything are the ones running the family empire, right? So I view it as ultimately Bitcoin rises to a better role of money. And because of that, you have fairer, more efficient economic calculation, and you realize the opportunity space of what could we be doing if we're not dealing with 2% interest rates, right? And we're dealing with whatever those fair market valuations are. You're going to have really big projects that are going to be high risk, but high reward, mining asteroids, like whatever that crazy stuff like Elon Musk is always talking about. Like, there's going to be a whole opportunity space once the money properly gets repriced and people better understand risk, because interest rates are risk at the end of the day. And with these low interest rates right now, why would you take a big moonshot risk when, you know, there's no reason to? Like, the hurdle rate's so low. Like, it's just totally like literally you could just go buy dog coins and you could probably be okay. Right? That's the other investment thesis, that people are going further and further out on the risk curve to get any meaningful return, because with interest rates so low, there's nothing left. All the meat's been picked off the bone.
Yeah. Yeah. I loved, I thought that was one of the most impactful part of the conversation between Peter and Eric, was sort of that analogy about walking into a room and whether it looks any different from the 1970s or today. I really agree with him, and it really struck me. I started looking at everywhere I was going through that lens. And you mentioned artificial intelligence there, and that kind of brings me to your interaction with Mark Cuban. And how the hell did that come together? How did that happen?
This is a funny story, only because it was so serendipitous. Like, I was not planning this. So, like, all I did, I saw Preston was going back and forth with Mark on Twitter, and I was laughing and liking the tweets and kind of giggling along. And then I'm currently set up in my, I'm actually in my wife's office right now. I'm set up in my basement. I went down to the basement to, I probably went to like go change the laundry or something. And I saw Preston opened up a Twitter space saying, "Hey Mark, if you're man enough, like come talk to me about it." So I joined the Twitter space, and there's like 10 people in the audience. And I raised my hand to like, and here I'm thinking Mark Cuban is not in the room. It's Preston Pish and no one else speaking. And I join specifically. I was like, oh, like I'm going to laugh with Preston about this, probably hang out for 10, 15 minutes and then jump off. And then I'm on stage. I talked to Preston for a couple of minutes, a couple of other people join. And Preston's like, oh, I've never run one of these Twitter spaces before. Like, what should I do? And I was like, oh, well, like, you know, if you're not comfortable, Preston, find someone you trust and have them co-host the room. So you have someone who can help bring people up, bring people down. And like, and he's like, who said that? And I was like, me, Rob. He's like, that's good enough for me, Rob. You can co-host. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, fine. So I was co-hosting. So I was helping run the space for a bit. And then Mark Cuban walks in and I, for the most part, tried to be quiet only because it wasn't my space to have a conversation, right? Like this was Preston's fight. And then the room kept blowing up because people saw that Mark Cuban was there talking. So Peter swings on by and Lynn Alden stops by. And it just kind of like, and it was the funniest thing. I went from like 2,000 Twitter followers to like 5,500 within like an hour. And then like my DMs blew up because every single person was like, hey, Rob, let me on stage. And I was like ignoring the, I was like, I'm just going to focus on the conversation because I don't know what the hell's going on. But I wrote that article for Bitcoin Magazine because I wanted to try and give, again, like a good faith interpretation, like summary highlights mm-hmm. of the conversation with Mark Cuban. And at the end of the day, like he has and actually I haven't talked about this publicly, but I shot him an email the next day saying like, hey, I wrote this article for Bitcoin Magazine, summarizing it, really appreciated the chat. And he responded within like 30 seconds.
Wow.
Was not expecting that. He's like, hey, yeah, I saw your article, you know, like basically to the effect of like, you know, it's not that I don't get it. We just disagree. And I was like, okay, thanks. Have a great day. Cause I'm not trying to like, among Bitcoiners, I know Bitcoiners are always disagreeable, and about Bitcoin, I'm super disagreeable to people who shit on it. But among Bitcoiners, I'm very like live and let live kind of chill. I'm not usually the one who's going to like pick a bunch of fights with people. But when I'm talking to Mark Cuban, I'm like, okay, yeah, whatever. You know, thanks for the chat. Thanks for replying. Have a great day. But the whole conversation was really funny because all of a sudden I ran upstairs and I told my wife, I was like, hey, I'm going to be gone for the next, like, I don't know how long because I'm talking to Mark Cuban. She looks at me, she's like, you're talking. And I take my AirPods out and she hears Mark Cuban talking. She's like, what are you doing? I was like, I'm talking to Mark Cuban on Twitter. So then she went and like tuned in and listened to it. It was funny. But it was really funny, serendipitous, long conversation about all of the different, you know, trade-offs between the crazy Bitcoin maxis and his view of the world.
Yeah, I mean, I gave him a lot of credit for getting in the room. It did feel like
absolutely Preston
called him out to a fight after school and everyone could watch. I think I gave him a lot of credit because it was going to be a very, I probably felt like 99% of the people in there were Bitcoin maxis. Anyone let up on stage was essentially a Bitcoin maxi. So he was, you know, it was one on many. I gave him a lot of credit for staying in the room. I think he kind of saw it more as sort of, you know, just creating entertainment and kind of just getting, you know, I think he just enjoyed being the aspect of 15,000 people listening.
Yeah.
For myself, though, I wasn't really fond of his arguments. I didn't think they really held, you know, water. And I think, you know, when like he would kind of, we would be talking about you guys would be talking about decentralization or just sort of, he would mention that Bitcoin has competitors and he doesn't like any team when he goes to invest money that thinks they're infallible. And he somehow Solana came up and it was like, dude, that was shut down for 6 hours on a Discord group. Like, what are you talking about here?
Yeah, or, that was a
coup. You know, he's going to put all his faith in Vitalik to solve the transition to proof of stake. And they just kind of like sounded like the fiat arguments that we've already refuted. And I think even one of the most poignant parts where he was just, okay, fine. Inflation's out of control. But maybe, just maybe, artificial intelligence will generate enough productivity, I don't know, 20% a year to outpace the inflation. And not only was that, you know, sort of getting into the conversation around like, well, he thinks Bitcoiners are selling a myth. Now he's selling a myth. And McCormack called him out on that. But you, I think, really came in there, I think, at that moment with a really interesting point. I don't know if you remember what I'm referring to.
Yeah, Peter Thiel's. So, Peter Thiel, and I actually link it in the article. This article was not someone I was planning to write. It was just one that being in the room for the Twitter spaces, I hit up CK for CK Snarks from Bitcoin Magazine. I was like, hey, I was in the room. Like, do you want me to do like a summary article? So like totally unplanned. I just did that. So Peter Thiel has this perspective on, he calls it cryptocurrency in general, right? As the bucket of technology where the two emergent for, and let me know if this is where you thought I was going. For the 21st century, the two emergent forces that are really coming out as new breakthrough technologies is artificial intelligence and cryptocurrency. And with cryptocurrency, you have this very libertarian, free market, associative minded opportunity. And with AI, you actually, it's a bit of a version of communism in the sense that with AI, you have this idea that you have the supreme intelligence that has full data transparency, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, central bank digital currencies. If you could see literally all of the transactions and the user profiles, if you just had all of the data, you could make a perfect system of centrally planned economies, right? So he made a point about maybe AI can figure this out. And I said, this is Peter Thiel's thesis, is that the 21st century is going to be a conversation between bottom up, you know, Bitcoin led freedom versus top down AI communism. And he said, that's not true. And I was like, well, it is. But, and then sure enough, I linked to it later in my article. The other really interesting point I found, I think he was having a, he wanted to like get in the mud a little bit and wrestle around. One, two, I think he wanted to play with the technology of what Twitter spaces can do. And now I think he realizes that he can walk into a room and just get 15,000 people to like listen and talk to him, which is an interesting, independent of who you are. Like that's a really interesting concept, right?
I think it's a Shark Tank experience for him.
It was, right? Like,
you know, he's on stage and people are listening to what he has to say. And I almost felt like that almost was going to make him antagonistic or sort of just trying to be, take the opposite side just to have conflict. I think he, you know, from TV, I think he's versed in the art of that. So I think like, and I do think he believed what he was saying. I just don't think he's done the research either. But I do think he's, you know, he was engaging for the sake of engaging, I think, in a lot of ways as well. It was sort of like a Saturday night for him.
He was at his gym.
Yeah. I mean, I thought it was a kind of exhilarating and fascinating, but it was kind of also a one-off for me. I don't think I would get as amped to have that opportunity again. It was really cool for everyone to be able to have a dialogue with him. I think it was classy for him to get in the room and be respectful and to take it all on. But I lost, I think, a lot of respect for his ideas, the way he thinks through things, how he's spending his time, what he thinks is important. I think Preston was really a man for calling him out on, you know, pumping Dogecoin and it's just bullshit. And that affects people's lives. And I think he's not really, you know, really distilling what that means economically for people and the importance of the times that we're in. I think one aspect of it, I do wish it stayed one-on-one with just him and Preston. So they could have had more of just a dialogue, because I do think it was unfair just in dynamics that everyone's coming in and they're all trying to, you know, throw their like Mike Tyson punch.
Right.
And totally agree. All from a different perspective, and just getting Mark all spun around and giving him an opportunity to just zigzag and not go deep on an argument. But I didn't really come away thinking that he had a lot of good points. And
specifically to that dynamic of like, you have eight Bitcoin maxis yelling at Mark Cuban. There's not a situation where he looks bad because he's like literally fending off like 8-1 right. people. It's also why for the most part I was quiet, because I felt like it wasn't one, it wasn't really my fight, and two, I'd only try to like add value when I had.
You added another great point, which was that Mark, like, we don't have to have the money going the opposite direction of the technology. We don't have to have these two things fighting each other. We can have deflation and technology bringing deflation and economic deflation or monetary deflation alongside each other.
Yeah. And then this was to his whole like inflation runaway, like having the government control things. I think from him, he was very strategic in that the moment he was kind of put in a corner, he would quickly pivot, because he's the one who mentioned Cardano. And like, obviously he like hadn't, like, I know I have spoken with people who were on the Multicoin Capital seed round for Cardano and got to buy Cardano at 4 cents. So when he's talking about Cardano's incredible investment, I was like, yeah, if you're a capital allocator like you, Mark, and you get to buy the
anything
token
with
4 cents.
Pre-mine.
Well, it's a pre-mine. Exactly. Yeah, you get to buy the token at 4 cents. Mind.
I mean, that's his accreditor investor and PE and venture capital and
Totally.
Yeah. And I think he's not seeing anything new in this.
Exactly. It's another vehicle.
And he's just taking advantage of his insider access, and he's just going to spray the darts. And all I heard from him was sort of marketing jargon. He spits out buzzwords, a little bit like how I look at Vitalik. You know, it's kind of like he's gone to a 45-minute presentation. He remembers, two or three of the snappiest, sort of hopium taglines, and says, "I'll put a moonshot on that."
Yeah, I think him voluntarily bringing up Cardano was a very funny, perfect example of something like that. I want to give him credit in the sense that he was much more prepared than I expected him to be. If you I could disagree with the points, but at least it was an interesting conversation. And there was a whole branch of a conversation talking about El Salvador as a circular economy, because the Bitcoin is not being mined there. It's being sent in from remittances. So that kind of hurt the Bitcoin model, which I'm not saying I agree with that thesis.
No,
I had never heard that critique before. I was like, this is a new critique.
It was new, but
I give him credit for not repeating, like, Bitcoin mining's boiling the oceans. You know what I mean? Maybe the bar's so low that him just having a unique insight is like something way further exceeding my expectations. Right. But
I think that it just spoke to his sort of thinking through this thing as like a pre-mine, or and that's his sort of way of thinking about it as organic or emergent.
Sure.
And he's not recognizing the work of the people who were remitting that value to El Salvador, the expats and the diaspora who are working for that money and converting either fiat to Bitcoin to send it home. It just missed that whole thing. And it just seemed like he was saying, like, well, if you don't have a chicken, well, you're not going to have an egg. And
yeah,
we have eggs and chickens right here. So, you're talking about, like, it's just, it was a frustrating conversation. When I boiled it down, I found it very frustrating. And I was hoping for more of a breakthrough,
I would agree with that. What I would have done was gotten Mark Cuban in the room and threw myself off stage and threw everyone else off stage and just let Preston and Mark go for like two hours. Like, that would have been my dream situation. Preston didn't know how to use Spaces though. Like, it was his first time using it. So I hung around, piped up a little bit. I know it became kind of like the bat signal went off and all of Bitcoin Twitter ran to the room.
I think there's also the notion that, I'll have the all-star team here and I could kind of bring up this person for that topic. And I get sort of that sort of decision that Preston had to make. And I understand why he went that way, but
totally.
I hope
it was all spontaneous. Again. No one planned on it. It was a Saturday night.
That's what
was
great about it.
It wasn't like everyone was like doing debate prep and getting ready to talk to Mark Cuban. It's funny. In the article, I described him as Mark Cuban, the man who Michael Goldstein pitched Bitcoin to in 2015 at South by Southwest. Like, there's a video of like Michael like haranguing like Mark Cuban. So it's just so funny that at $200 Bitcoin, and at that time it was like $50,000 Bitcoin, that he's going to still try to explain that like we got something wrong, even though he already missed out,
right?
Like on a massive multiple. It's like, okay, like, yeah, we went up 250x, but please tell us like why we're not right. Continue. Yeah.
Yeah, that was really interesting. I kind of wonder, you mentioned Chicago BitDevs, and I did go to my first BitDevs meeting last night, Chicago BitDevs. It was dope.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I had a blast. I totally got the vibe you're talking about. I got about 3% of the information that was being put across, but it was just really great to meet up with other Bitcoiners and have that environment. It reminded me a little bit of Bitcoin 2021 and BitBlock Boom, and just getting to meet people. I'd love to hear, like, maybe your take on American HODL's presentation at BitBlock Boom and sort of what Bitcoiners can do in the future, the Bitcoin Mafia. Oh, so
I was not at BitBlock Boom. I bought tickets, though, and I saw his speech on YouTube. So I know what you're talking about, but I'll be at Miami and I'll be at BitBlock Boom for next year. But I loved the framing of basically being like Gollum in Lord of the Rings and trying to destroy the one-time Cantillon effect. Like, basically Bitcoiners who have Bitcoin we almost have an obligation and responsibility to not just sit on the money that we made by being right, but by truly trying to destroy the Cantillon effect by investing and trying to break the cycle and invest in new businesses when Bitcoin hits its appreciation. I think that's something that loosely ties back into like stagnation of that. Basically, like, you need to start taking these moonshot projects and trying to find new things to like shake and break and try and like re-see the world and not be so complacent with the way things have always been. And I think that's it's been a while since I watched it, his speech, but I think it's totally directionally in the right place. I like his framing of Bitcoin as Silicon Valley was a libertarian left movement and Bitcoin is a libertarian right movement, which I would agree with. And that basically you have this, like, you had the PayPal mafia from Silicon Valley, but now it's like kind of like the Bitcoin mafia of all of these people who from different corners and connections have like following down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and like becoming our own tight-knit community. Like, those are all resoundingly agree with. I wasn't sure if there was a particular point you wanted to like talk about more.
Yeah. I just thought it was inspiring. You wrote a tweet on October 2nd that I personally found very inspiring that I'd like to share. You wrote, "I quit my job 5 months ago. My goal was to refocus my priorities so that I could focus on what was important in life. More time with my kids, be healthier, time to read and write, tinkering, prototyping, ideas. Thank you, Bitcoin, for the opportunity and inspiration." I really found that tweet moving. It's really kind of impacted my life. It was sort of my third tag on that notion, alongside my interview with Jimmy Song and Daniel Prince, where I decided to go full time with the show and pursue other opportunities as well in Bitcoin. This tweet was sort of the cap, you know, on that.
Wow. Yeah. I'm honored and flattered to hear that.
So how's your time been since you made this decision?
Yeah. So I left my job basically right as Bitcoin Miami kicked off in June. A lot of that initial, I was working without exaggeration, 75 to 80 hour weeks. I had a kid with another one on the way, and had never really spent a lot of time and with my children. And it was something that was, I was very forwardly present about that. Like, I was earning a good paycheck. I was definitely sharpening my professional skills. It wasn't like it was all like for naught, but it wasn't a grind and it wasn't something I had to put myself through. So I went to Miami, which was a fun kind of blow off party, like meeting Bitcoiners on random beaches in South Beach and drinking and, you know, sharing stories. One of my very funny side stories was that we were going to, it was the last night after the conference, just as a funny, just like throwaway story. We walked from, funny enough, Preston Pish's bar crawl to the closest liquor store to then go meet a bunch of people at the beach and
for the wedding.
I was at the wedding. Yeah. Were you at the wedding?
No, I wasn't at the wedding.
Oh, so I was at, yeah. So I went to the wedding and
Gigi, I started on the Telegram group, I think.
And
I
was, so Gigi offered to buy everyone drinks, but he didn't have any cash on him. So, and I had my credit card and I put it on my tab and he was sending me lightning invoices from my node. I was using like my Ellen Zeus app. So I was using, I was like talking to my node all the way back away from Florida. And he just like vent, like the equivalent of like, "Oh, I'm going to Venmo you." Like, he just like lightning networked me. It was the funniest experience. But yeah, so crazy fun time in Miami. Really got me super passionate about Bitcoin in general, just because I'd passively been following it for so many years, but this is my first time like really jumping in with both feet. And then getting back and just starting to like having the bandwidth and time, especially before my son was born, to be able to just like, you know what, I'm going to work on this random project, right? I'm just going to like throw some code together, not have it be like stressful deadlines and trying to figure things out, but just having the freedom almost like in an artistic form to be able to start just like throwing like ideas in my head and making them real with code, which was one of the biggest things for why I wanted to do programming. Like, the first throwaway project I did with programming was I actually wrote a bot that sat on top of the local shelter website and sent me pictures of dogs that as the moment they would get listed for adoption, I would get a text to my phone. And it's actually how I ended up adopting my dog, was because I was first in line for the dog, because I knew exactly when he showed up. But like that kind of freedom, artistic freedom, right? To be able to sit down, take a couple hours, work on a project, and kind of like for the sake of building itself, as opposed to I have a deadline and a client expectation and I need to kind of get it out the door, right? Being my own master in that sense. And then spending time with my kids, which has been really rewarding. At the moment, I'm officially a full-time dad. That's just kind of the way things fall at the moment. And it's been really rewarding. Like I really love being able to spend that time with my kids. And the health stuff, I'm well on a path. I've definitely dropped some weight. I want to do more going in, especially into the new year, having the time to be able to fully, you know, even if it's sometimes just like being able to not drink as much, right? Like if I'm like working late into the night and I'm like drinking, it's like I can go to sleep back when I was working, you know, so many hours during the week. Being able to go on like long walks, like especially with my kids, like did like a nice long, like 2 mile walk today with my kids and the stroller. It's been an interesting centering time for me because I've been working and hard for so long. And I finally got this little bit of breathing room to be able to kind of figure out what I want to do next. And it's really interesting the moment that you take a step back because you want to work on things that you want to, all of the job offers start flooding in. When you're not trying to frantically look from job to job, now that I'm kind of just been figuring out what I want to do, having offers flow inward to me has been really interesting, rewarding in the sense that I have that flexibility now where I want to keep on working. But I want to find work that I personally find empowering and enjoying as opposed to doing something for a paycheck. So all of that stuff. And the reason why I say Bitcoin afforded it to me was that ultimately, because it's not like I sold a bunch of Bitcoin. I have like a yacht somewhere now. It's that it's given me the ability to have a cushion to be able to take a step back and step away from the rat race and reorientate my priorities. And what do I want to focus my time and effort into? Right. And it's giving me like people talking like time is your most scarce resource. And I think like Bitcoin's afforded me to have the time to spend like with my kids, which has been an incredible gift to allow me to have that refocusing on what's truly important and being able to, you know, have that clarity and optionality to kind of think about, since I'm enjoying this so much, I want to find things that are extremely high value to take me away from that. It's not just going to be a job that pays a paycheck, right? So it's been, and it's kind of an open-ended, just kind of ramble, but that's kind of what it's been for me. And it's been a really great journey.
I think you distilled that really well. And myself, you know, I'm hungrier and more ambitious than ever, but it's allowed me to, you know, like I'm similar to you. I don't have a yacht and, you know, I hope to never, you know, spend a sat. But it's allowed me a little bit of a moment to take, you know, step back, focus a little bit more on what I want to do and really focus on this podcast and focus on Bitcoin. That's just been really huge. I think a lot of it is mentally too, you know, and I say this a lot, but just the, you know, your very first Satoshi, especially the ones that you bring to your own keys, I think it was really a paradigm shift in sort of how you see money, how you see your time. And I think one of the reasons I brought up American HODL's talk is that, you know, he kind of took it a little further out in terms of capital allocation, but I see it already with yourself and myself with time allocation. So it's not even spending the Bitcoin, you know, it's not even having a lot of Bitcoin. It's just being able to spend your time differently now. And, you know, maybe further out, we can talk about what American HODL got into and see that more in play. But I think you're seeing it in people's time. They're taking moonshots.
Yeah.
You know, they're spending time with their family. They're, you know, it's very different. Like for myself, like when I was billing 58, 55 hours a week and then doing the pod on top of that, I wasn't spending as much time with my family. So I just dreamt about the day that Bitcoin would give me that more time, you know.
No, it's a really, it's such a hard conversation to have with people outside of Bitcoin because I remember when I got into Bitcoin, like, and like the price went from 200 to 400. We were like, oh, did you sell it? Right. And they didn't understand like what the larger trade was happening. And having a lot of those conversations now, people were being like, oh, well, you got in back then. There's no way this keeps on growing. One, I personally don't believe, I think this is still very early stages and days. And it's why it's why I haven't sold all my Bitcoin so I can go have a yacht somewhere, right? Like not even that I could afford a yacht. It's just the matter of fact of like the resource being viewed not as money, but as time is such a critical piece of it. And I think it's such a, it's a full reset of like a value orientation, what you're spending your time on and being able to better cult. Like you basically have this value structure that says, I'm going to defer gratification, I'm going to save. And you're able to have those values have a better iterative feedback loop on being able to better guide what your next set of actions are going to be. And I think this is the thing where, you know, you don't change Bitcoin, Bitcoin changes you, where you've put your full trust into leaning into something and it affords you this better opportunity and better life. And because of that, you on the next feedback loop of like your actions, you're going to be more centered and more focused on the things that truly bring you passion. And you're going to be less likely to be tempted by what maybe you from a year before you had Bitcoin would be able to influence you with. It's this weird concept, but I think like you could just be shorthand say like, you know, your fiat life versus like your Bitcoin life would maybe ways people could grok it. But like it's this continual process where over cycles, over years, and I think it's especially easy in these bull markets when the price is shooting up compared to where it's been, it's easy to kind of look at it with like rose-tinted glasses, like it's all great, but it wasn't like it was easy. Like HODL says this all the time that like it's very simple, but it's not easy to HODL.
Right.
Right. Because every day you have to wake up and decide, oh, I have X amount of Bitcoin. I could have Y amount of resources and Z amount of joy. No, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to keep it on a global distributed encrypted database. And I'm going to just keep on like debating if I should sell my chairs or not. Right. Like you have this whole, but because you value the deferring of gratification, you unlock what's even more important than money. It's time. And it really is such an incredible way of influencing things. And that's where I'm kind of now thinking about what I'm going to be spending my time on doing next. I don't see myself as retired. Yeah. Not by any means. Like I'm almost kind of like eager to like jump back in the ring and like work on stuff. But again, work on stuff that I find more valuable and I'm not just working for a paycheck. So that's kind of where I'm trying to figure out next. Maybe put in a article or two for Bitcoin Magazine along the way. I've been early drafting up some new stuff, but I got to sit down and get the time to dedicate the writing to it.
Yeah. It kind of touches on the notion of, you know, the individual is the only group that could kind of withstand the pressures of the embedded growth obligation.
Yes.
You know, and talking about Bitcoin 2021, it was a trip to get to meet Gigi. I got to meet him. I think first thing I got to the hotel, came down from the lobby with my wife and, you know, mm-hmm. there he was talking to Ali Hammam. And it was a trip to get to meet him. And I kept seeing him all over Bitcoin 2021. And I purposely didn't take a picture with him.
Yeah.
So that I could have the image of him almost recede in my memory and go mm-hmm. back to the invisible man next time I talked to him on the pod.
Totally.
I like that notion so much. And I like the beauty of that. So it was just really a treat to meet him. And it was a lot of fun. And he was just even more interesting in person.
Absolutely.
I can't wait till April and I hope to get to meet you there.
I'll be there.
Be dope. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'll be there.
For sure.
I've enjoyed this conversation immensely. This has been so dope. Please let everyone know where they could find you and your work.
Oh yeah. My Twitter handle is at Rob1Ham, R-O-B, the number one, H-A-M. You can find me at Bitcoin Magazine under Rob Hamilton. You can find me on Clubhouse at ROB, the number one HAM. You'll find me in the Bitcoin rooms. But yeah, I keep my DMs open and everything. Shoot me a note. Always happy to chat.
Yeah, man. I hope to see you in Miami and I'll definitely see you on Clubhouse and Spaces. Thanks so sure. much, bro.
Awesome. Yeah. Take care, Cedric.
Rob Hamilton on his rabbit hole story, meeting Vitalik and getting his time back with Bitcoin right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And this episode was brought to you by Ledin, Bitcoin Magazine, and the Bitcoin 2022 conference. Ledin.io is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. Ledin is the first digital asset lender with the transparency and security of a formal proof of reserves attestation, raising the bar in the space. To open your account and get $50 free in USDC when you take out your first Ledin loan, make sure to head over to start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. Remember, Prices for the Bitcoin 2022 conference will continue to go up, so go and buy your tickets now. And make sure to use the code BitcoinMatrix for 10% off your tickets at checkout. And thank you for listening. Please subscribe, share, and write a dope 5-star review on Apple. And if you want to support me and the show directly, Bitcoin tips are enabled on Twitter at SedYungleman. Your continued support means a lot. Stack sats, stay humble, and stay laser focused out there. This is Cedric. Peace.